We are still growing and achieving and combating the evils of this world. We comprise about 13% of the country's population. But you would think by the reactions of some people when we do good things, bad things, that we comprise a much bigger percentage. So my journey into racism did not begin as a child. It did not begin really early. It only really began in 2014, in August, after Mike Brown was killed. I was born and raised in Normandy, Missouri, another little small town in North County. Very strong family background, parents, grandparents, faith leaders, justice leaders. So people always encouraged us to esteem our blackness, to review it as something beautiful, our hair texture. You don't put chemicals in it to straighten it so that it's straighter like the white man's or the white woman's, but you are beautiful just as you are. So that's kind of, you know, messaging that I always heard growing up. I had friends who were black, who were white, who were Hispanic. We went to churches that were black, that were white, that were Hispanic. And so it wasn't this whole, you know, thing of racial oppression in my life. My thought process that I can admit now was that because my family was doing well, my grandfather, he owned a home, he had life insurance, he had whole life insurance. And, you know, when he passed away, not only was his house paid for, but so were two cars. And so my mom and other aunts and uncles received an inheritance. You don't really hear that too much in the black community from, you know, the generation before my parents because of the lack of opportunity and things of that nature. However, in my life, that was the norm. And so we thought that since we're doing okay as black people, but others aren't, it must be them. They must not be working hard enough. They did not put on their bootstraps as we did. We went to school and we raised our family and we waited until we were married to have children. All of the, you know, staples in society that deems one a good person, a person worthy of time and attention and things of that nature. And so finally, so I was in school, getting my master's degree, looking at North County. I've always wanted to do something for the region because I grew up there. I grew up going to Showbiz Pizza, as it was, and Halls Ferry 8 Cinema, later became Halls Ferry 14. We had restaurants and places to go to for entertainment, for shopping, you know, nice homes, lawns, flowers, all of that good stuff. And then my husband joined the army. We got married. He moved away. And we came back 4 years later, and things were very, very different. There were a lot more vacancies. There were a lot different changes with the schooling and demographics. We bought our house, you know, where we live because that's where we knew. He grew up in Hazelwood. I grew up in Normie, then Florissant. And so we bought our house there to send our kids to school in the area because at the time, they were really good school districts. You know, they were top. Ferguson Florissant was like a really top school district at one point. And so I began to notice different things. Business closures, foreclosures, loss of jobs. But the infrastructure was always still there. And so I decided, after I got my master's degree in 2012, I was working as a corporate paralegal in Clayton. And so I had access to attorneys and business leaders and leasing agents and bankers and all of the people necessary to really do something strong with economic development. And so I was going to convene an economic development summit for North County. Get people in the room, get them talking, show them what could be possible for North County if there was just an investment. Again, not realizing that the component that was missing was the white flight. And not only the people who moved away from North County, but the people who had businesses in North County. And so when they moved, eventually they closed the businesses and brought them up to where they lived. Didn't that piece did not dawn on me. I just thought it was the changing of the times of, you know, economic development, closures, and things of that nature. And so when Mike Brown was killed in 2014, August 9th, 2014, and the two sides of the community responded the way they did, within with the protest and then the riots eventually, but then the other people talking super badly about Mike Brown and his mom and calling him thug and worse words, I was blown away. My bubble completely popped. And it was like, huh? We still have this level of racism here in North County, here in St. Louis. Like, growing up, I heard about different instances of racism in other areas of the community, South County, for example. One thing that stands out to me was when the KKK wanted to adopt a portion of the highway. I was in high school when that happened. And there was kind of a big hurrah about that. And so eventually they said, yes, you can put a sign up, but then they called the portion of the highway the Rosa Parks Highway, so that they would be cleaning up on the Rosa Parks Highway. So that kind of thing I knew about, you know, with South County. And then parts of St. Charles County. It was one of those things that I actually saw it firsthand a little bit later on in my life. We had a house fire in 2006. And so we lived in St. Charles County briefly while we were waiting to move back into our home after repairs were done. And that was an experience. It was kind of like, oh, wow, I'm in a different world. You know, my husband and I, we have five children. And so just us going anywhere was always kind of like a, not really a circus. Picture like the clown cars, people getting out one after the other. Is it ever going to stop? But there was also the, you have five kids? Wow. But then they found out I'm married. Oh, you're married and you have five kids. Like, okay, what's that all about? So, back to my talk. So then August 2014 comes around, and the responses were, I mean, astronomical from, and I don't want to say both sides because someone else said that, but from both ends, they were astronomical, and I was really perplexed. My white friends who I went to church with, who I sang on the worship team with, and like I said, we have five kids, four sons. One of my sons is a big, you know, 5'9", bulky guy with long dreadlocks, and I thought to myself, God forbid, but what if that were him? What would they say about my son who wouldn't hurt a flea, let alone a fly? The child sings opera. I mean, he's just a big, beautiful black boy, but some of the comments that they were making on Facebook were unbelievable. These were people, like I said, we did life together. We had meals together. And these were Christians. So it was really, really mind-blowing, really mind-blowing. And so I began to look at my idea of economic development and think, okay, we need a bit more of an investment in the area, not just in the buildings and in the jobs, but in the relationships, in the healing, in like the really historical context of what it means to live as a black person, as a brown person in St. Louis. And so I spent about a year and a half being really angry, like really angry. I was so angry. I began to get sick of myself being angry. And I tried to get over the disappointment and the frustration. But then there were continually more and more instances, things coming up about the young man in Ohio who was at a park playing with a toy gun, and the police just drove up and shot him. Instances with the young man in Walmart playing with a toy gun, and he was shot. I mean, just constantly. And again, I have four sons. So every time I look at these instances, and my sons have friends, so every time I have to send them out, every time they have to leave and get in a car and go somewhere, as innocent as it could be the end of their lives for something as ugly as racism. But what is it that makes skin tone such that we have to differentiate people? We have, I mean, as humans, no one is one particular color. We have different color hair, different eye color. We have different shades of skin tone, even in the white and black races. You know, we use terms light skin versus dark skin versus brown skin. We have people who are paler than others, people who absorb more sun than others. So at some point, all of us at some point are colored, or people of color, as the new terminology goes. But what is it about skin tone, about origin, ethnic origin, that causes us to treat people differently, see people differently, ascribe different traits to them? So one of the things that, as I'm in school, first, okay, I got over my year of being angry, finally, by three significant groups and events. One, I joined politics. 2016 was coming up, and I was involved in Obama's race, and that was a lot of fun. A lot of fun. So I said, okay, we had a black president. He was, you know, good for the most part. No one's perfect. He did some things that I probably would not have agreed with had I paid more attention. But we figured, okay, we're moving on. Let's continue this trajectory. Yeah. Uh-huh. You know it. And so I got involved in politics, and I saw that Hillary Clinton was running, but I wanted to see just who else was out there. I wasn't a big Hillary fan. I was, you know, kind of a teenager in the 90s, so I didn't really pay attention to much of what Bill did. But I wanted to find out, you know, just who else was running out there. And so I began to look at, you know, people from both spectrums, Republicans and Democrats, because I don't really vote along party lines. I look at the candidate and their issues. And so for a while, I was interested in Rand Paul. He actually came to Ferguson and, you know, tried to do some things with his medical degree after everything happened. So I began to look at him and see, okay, let me check him out. Let me see who else is out there. And then I came upon the campaign of Bernie Sanders. And his message, I didn't know much about him because, you know, he was from Vermont, and no one paid attention to Vermont unless it's syrup. And so I wanted to see, okay, what he's talking about. And I just really appreciated how open and honest he was about issues, about income inequality, about race. You know, he did not shy away when the killer killed all of the people in the church, Dylann Roof, all the black people. He did not shy away from calling it a hate crime. He was not one of those people who said, well, let's look and see, let's assess all of the facts. No, he called it point blank. It was racism. And so I got really involved in his campaign and eventually joined and drove to Iowa a couple of times and canvassed. And that was a lot of fun, but I met some really, really good people. You know, aside from Bernie and his ideals, but the people on the campaign were just like me. They were in bubbles. They thought that we had a black president and we have other black people like the Oprahs in the world who are doing well, that we must be moving along as a society. And so it was kind of like my white sister, you know, I can actually talk about these things to people who understood, who got it. And so that was one of the ways that helped me to heal. The other way was my cousin formed a group called the Mercy Project. And it was a group of moms, kind of fashioned after moms against drunk driving, but these were moms against racism. And so these were moms from all different backgrounds, Christian, Jewish, agnostic, whatever. But we all had children, and we all wanted to figure out a better way to discuss with our children race and racism and how to handle things that come up, whether it's in school with like-minded people or when you're out in society with people who do not look like you. How can we better foster better race relations? And so getting with those group of moms, you know, and like I said, they were all from different backgrounds, religious backgrounds, political backgrounds. There were some of his supporters there. And so, you know, we had to kind of navigate through the fact that we're all different, but at the end of the day, we all bleed red. All blood is red. And so that was kind of like the beginning of my journey into forming a red circle. The third piece was, one of the churches in North County did a book study on a book called Racism, America's Original Sin. And that was a very, very profound book by a man named Jim Walls. He heads up the I want to say Matthew 25, Sojourner's website. If you ever get a chance to look that up, that's a really good resource. And he broke down some really heavy statistics on what race and racism has done to the people in this country. He went from incarceration to housing to jobs to education. He really, really broke it down. And the fact that the church that hosted it was a predominantly white church. And so they got their white members in to a room to discuss racism, to discuss what policing means to them versus to me. And so that was very profound. So between those three happenings and items, I was able to heal and begin to turn my anger into action. And so after Bernie's campaign, he said, "You guys, we started this revolution and we're getting more involved in the political process and the policy process. Don't let it stop there. Run for office, get involved, find out what's happening in your local elections." Well, I am not a politician. I do not like the ugliness of the competition. I'm watching some of my friends now, you know, beat each other up on Facebook about this race and that race, and I'm like, oh my gosh, please release primaries, come on. But I do enjoy policy. I do enjoy serving my community. I do enjoy knowledge and empowerment. And so I decided to go back to school to get my PhD in public policy and administration. So I'm currently doing that now. And so that was like a really good stepping stone to being able to do research into St. Louis's racist real estate history. So I had to write an ethics paper, and I was going to frame it from the breakup between the city and county, because I've always lived in the county. And so I figured that that was maybe some type of a route to the battle between the city and the county and why there's racism in different ways here. You know, St. Louis County is a little bit more prosperous and things of that nature. So as I began to dive into my books and my reading, I learned a whole lot more. I learned about things like redlining with real estate and the Shelley versus Kramer lawsuit with the restrictive deed covenants. So there was something written in your deed. You know, you buy a house, you get a deed. Well, in the deed, it specified that you cannot sell your house to a black family. And so this was something that happened from the Great Migration onward until around the 1970s. Like the last case, there were several U.S. Supreme Court cases from St. Louis, let alone Missouri, just about housing and real estate. One of the most popular ones is Shelley versus Kramer. That was decided in 1948. There was a family in the city. You know, they said blacks can live here. The rest of the whites can live here. Well, you get so many more black people coming from the South and other places. They, you know, slavery ended, Reconstruction, emancipation without a plan. And so black people were just kind of nomads going to and fro, trying to figure out their place in this world after the Civil War. But someone decided, well, let's go north. Let's figure this out. Let's go west. Let's figure this out. So that was the Great Migration. And so a lot of blacks came here to St. Louis, where they were met with resistance from the other ethnic groups, the Irish and the Italian, because at that time people were still identifying by where they came from with their family background, not necessarily white. And so they were like, well, we have the jobs here already. We don't want you here. We have the houses here already. We don't want you here. And so blacks were pigeonholed into a certain spot of town, certain jobs, certain, you know, schools and things like that. And so what happened was the Kramers wanted to move. They wanted to move into a better house. And I'm sorry, the Shelleys. They wanted to move into a better house. They wanted to move out of the little pigeonhole place that they could move into and move somewhere bigger. Well, there was this deed covenant. They could not buy the house because they were black. And so eventually that went to court. It went from, you know, all the way St. Louis City up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So that's the Shelley versus Kramer. The most recent one was Jones v. Mayer, and that was actually in the city of Florissant, near where I live, in the 70s. So we bought our house. It was built in the 60s. I told my kids, we're the second family to live in that house. When this house was first built, we would not have been able to buy this house. That's just, you know, just one instance of the racism here in St. Louis. And so as I'm going through all my research, learning about deed covenants and redlining and zoning laws and how they zone so that you can dump your toxic waste and things near where black people lived, near where poor people lived. Highway construction. You ever wonder why Highway 40 is where it is and Highway 70 is where it is and 270 and how it kind of dissects the neighborhoods on socioeconomic levels? That was designed by racism. So sometimes I kind of laugh at people when they ask me, why do I make everything about race? And I say, because your ancestors made everything about race. I mean, everything from where people could go to school to where they could eat to the quality of food that is in their neighborhoods. All goes along race. So after my research, it kind of got me angry again. But by then, I was doing something productive with it, and so I was able to continue on with my education. But then later on in my studies, I had to create a strategic plan for a not-for-profit. And I decided to write about North County and the things that we need. It was going to be called His Hands and Feet. And it was going to be based on the phrase, being the hands and feet of Christ. So His Hands were going to be me and my volunteers meeting short-term needs, you know, food pantry type things, collecting hats and gloves for children who had coats but not hats and gloves, things of that nature, but also looking at long-term policy solutions. That was going to be His feet. So, okay, we'll do the food pantry, but let's look at hunger. Let's look at why there are so many people in this 1 square mile radius that need to have food served during the summer from the libraries. Why can't these families provide food? What is going on in this particular area? And so as I'm going through the plan for school, I decided, okay, I can actually do this. Why not? Why? I mean, I have 5 kids. I'm always a person who just kind of takes on a lot. And so I'm still working as a paralegal in the corporate law. But that was beginning to get difficult because in addition to corporate law, I also did insurance defense. And we had cases of excessive force. And when we got those cases, we had to represent the police. We had to represent the jailers and the different people. And so sometimes I would have to read through transcripts about, you know, what someone did to someone. Or watch videos and watch the white cop slam the black person up against the wall, up against the car. And I'd be able to say anything because that's my job. You know, I have to represent them to the best of my ability. Well, eventually, as I'm going through this process with this, with the plan, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, what do I want to see in my community? How can we combat the effects of racism? Not necessarily racism itself, because that is more of an inherent belief system that couples prejudice with power. And so in order to combat racism, the people who are prejudiced are in power, have to be the ones to do that, meaning white people, meaning the people who can have a say in whether you hire a black person or not. That is racism itself. But the effects of racism, the hunger, the lack of jobs, the different things like that that happened in our community because of the white flight from the 80s and 90s, what can I do? What can we do as a group, as a not-for-profit, to combat that? And so we decided we have 5 focus areas. Employment, education, holistic living, which is a combination of health and financial wellness, policy, and the arts. And so our employment team, at first we started out looking at helping people find jobs, doing resumes and things of that nature. But it became clear that that work was already being done. So finding a job wasn't the issue. It was being able to keep a job because of different things like not having soft skills, not having child care, not having transportation, all of those bigger nuances that interfere with someone being able to be successful to keep a job. Our education, We know that black children are suspended at higher rates than white children. We know that there are some implicit biases in educating black children versus white children. There is an Amy Hunter TED Talk, and she gives an example about the graduation rates of one school that's a predominantly black school. You know, it's maybe like 60%. And people go, oh, okay. But what if I told you that 60% of the kids from Clayton High School were not going to graduate? Well, then you would galvanize into action, because that is the anomaly, not the norm. And so there are all these inherent biases that then infiltrate into how we then treat the people. It's one thing to have a bias within you, but if you let that bias decide and determine how to treat someone, then that becomes problematic. Like if I see two people, you know, someone comes in here, he's dressed kind of shabbily, I might think, oh wow, I don't want him in here. But if I still welcome him, if I still let him sit on the front row, then I have not treated him any differently. The bias was only within. But once that bias becomes something that we actually then treat someone differently, that's, like I said, that's where it becomes the problem. So that's where racism went to. You know, back in the days when they were colonizing and people were moving west and the government was pushing the natives off to the side and, you know, giving land and things of that nature. After slavery ended, we did not get the acres. We weren't able to own land and things of that nature. So after slavery, if it was just, we don't like black people, but still you can have your land, we would be okay. But it's generations and generations, free labor, no land. Now we can finally own houses in around, like I said, the 70s, anywhere that we wanted to own. This isn't my generation. I was born in 75. This is my generation that we could finally buy a house anywhere we wanted to buy. And still, even some places, the redlining is kind of more under the covers, under the table. Real estate people will make sure that we show black people houses here and not here. Or they'll write things within the local ordinances that says you have to have your house on a certain plot of land that's so big, knowing that most black people won't be able to afford to buy that many acres. And so that is something that keeps black people out of certain neighborhoods. You can't legally discriminate, but they do it under the table. And so for what we do with a Red Circle is we empower, we educate, we provide tools, we provide knowledge and real talk. We open the door so that most of the time, like people who live in a certain area, they're very non-migratory. They have not moved from that area. So the people that they know are the same people who their parents knew. So they've never ever seen a different way of life. They've never seen that we can be educated, we can become doctors. And even in the media, in the arts, you watch a movie, it's very rare to see a black professional doctor. You know, they watch the TV and the news and the different, you know, fiction shows, and they see people who, you know, maybe the drug dealer or maybe the, you know, person who's running, you know, the streets and things of that nature. So that becomes inherent in their mind. I work with foster kids on the weekends, and we talked about voting and civics and being engaged yesterday, and you could tell just, these were, you know, 18 to 20-year-olds, so they weren't like little kids. These were kids who, you know, have gone to high school, but they've gone to high school within the same area of where they grew up, where their parents grew up. So you can tell the level of hope that is in their lives about what voting does, what it means, how it can change, how it can help is very low. Very low, because at the end of the day, to them, everyone is going to do what he or she wants regardless of who's in power, regardless of how we vote, so why should I? And so we try to open up the world. We try to broaden horizons. We do more of a hands up versus a hand out. So we have a garden. Like I drove up today and I'm in awe of this garden at the extension. So we just planted our garden a couple of weeks ago. So I will definitely be taking pictures when I leave here for my idea because I want to talk to the people about eating healthy. I served asparagus at my healthy food kitchen this past Friday. People had never seen it. They've seen it and didn't know how to cook it, and so they shy away from it. And so some of the things that we do, like with food pantries and things, you know, we have canned goods and things of that nature. And then we try to do fresh produce, but it's kind of like, what is this? What do I do with this purple cucumber-looking thing, you know, eggplant. So it's those types of things that we do. We talk to schools about discipline, about bias, about looking at the root cause of education through a racial equity lens. This child is falling asleep, or this child is acting out, this child is doing whatever. Let's look at the root cause of what's going on in this child's life. Let's look at the teacher. Let's see if maybe there's some training we need to do with implicit bias, with restorative justice. Don't just suspend a child. Let's try to get these suspension rates down, because then that will help increase the academic achievement. Like I said, we cannot eliminate racism. It's never going to go away unless the people who grew up on racism decide one day to not be racist. But we can give our students the tools to overcome it, to be able to do what they need to do despite it, or even use that to fuel them, to want to be well. But over the last few years, you know, you think about a crack in the windshield. It starts off as a little ding, and so you think, okay, I'll get that fixed. And then eventually you see a little bit of a bigger line. Ooh, I better really get that fixed. Well, eventually you have to replace the entire windshield because you have neglected the one little ding. That's what happened in North County when the people first started moving out. Oh, this business closed. Okay, let's get someone in here. Oh, this business closed. Uh-oh. Oh, 2008, housing crisis. Now we've got whole communities with 200 plus vacant houses and no businesses. What does that mean for our society? Well, now we have to find a whole new system. We have to think a whole new way to revive the economic health in the community. So we need to provide a way to make North County more attractive to business owners, to people who have the power to hire, to open businesses, to get something started in North County. So we have what I call Healthy Flavor, Bistro, and Garden. Eventually, when our garden looks like that one, we're probably not. But we will be serving seed-to-table style meals in the community as a place so that, one, people have somewhere within North County to go to have a nice meal that's affordable, that's fresh, made from local food, and two, people from without North County will then drive into North County. Right now, what we have as far as economics goes is, if you want to do something local, there are a few places that you can shop within, like Florissant, Ferguson, and parts of Hazelwood, and maybe parts of Jennings. But other communities like Pine Lawn or Jennings and Northwoods, most of the time people have to drive out. And so that affects the tax base. You know, as budgets are formed through sales taxes, if you're always having to leave where your zip code is to shop, then your property value is going to go down. And so what happens is there's less jobs because they're making less money within the region. And so people move. People don't want to live there. There's less tax revenue for schools. So then the schools become lower rated. And so when families are looking to move and they, you know, research, let's see how this school district is doing. They have children. Well, these five school districts are in one area and they're all at the bottom of your school district list. The people aren't going to move there. And so what's going to happen is those houses that are in the area that are vacant, no one's paying the taxes on them. No one is forming businesses to hire the people, so that people can buy the houses to pay the taxes, so that then the schools get tax revenue. It's all one big giant circle, but we all bleed red. Everyone in this room, if I cut myself, if I cut you, which I won't do, but we all bleed red. So it's time out for, you know, we're white, we stay here, you're black, you stay here, It's time out for that. And they tried to do, you know, good, bad, or indifferent, things like that with school segregation, school desegregation, I should say. But they did it backwards. They moved the brightest black kids into the whiter school districts and left all the other children in the school districts that then couldn't, you know, form a good school district once the other kids were gone. Even now, you know, there are kids that have bused from the city or from Normandy out to Parkway and Rockwood and things of that nature. But who's investing in the kids who are left behind? Who's investing in this cracked windshield? Eventually, one cracked windshield leads to maybe having to replace the entire car. And then you have black people who are living pretty much just the same as people who have to live on reservations, because there's nothing around them that they can use to sustain their lives. So there are several ways that people can get involved with A Red Circle. We're right in North County. We're local, not too far. The drive for me was probably about 20, 25 minutes, although I started getting to kind of the wilderness area, and I was like, okay, where are they taking me? Then I saw a car turn, and I'm like, okay, I'm okay now. But it's not that far, not that far. You can come to North County to get involved in our education work, in our healthy food work. If you know people who are interested in opening businesses, we have several vacant storefronts, vacant businesses. We have several homes if you're interested in doing any type of a community development association work, land trust work, anything like that that you want to do to make a difference in North County. You can also help to support us, the people who are doing the work, by donating. We are 501c3. I don't know if that matters now with the tax law, but we are. And so there are just really a lot of different ways to get involved, because like I said, the racism isn't just you feeling a certain type of way towards black people. I mean, you can like us, which would be great. You can not like us, which would be okay, so long as you're not treating us differently. As long as you're not withholding opportunities from us to work, to go to school, to play. I mean, right now, if I want to take my kids somewhere fun, we have to drive about 45 minutes to a place over in South County that I go to, Incredible Pizza. So there's really no place like that in North County. You know, we have a movie theater at the Mills. Well, it was the Mills. Now it's Scentless Outlet Mall. But that's about to change. Hopefully there's something that's going to be happening. But there are just so much that, because of, like I said, flight and racism and things of that nature, we have to change the way not only we think about it. Implicit bias is one thing, but implicit bias with action is the crux of the issue. So before I close, does anyone have any questions?